Joining me is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, can you just give us an introduction to who you are? Because you're actually an author as well, aren't you?
Well, I am an author. I had a book published in 1998 with my colleague Laszlo Andor about the transition period in the Eastern European economies. It's a bit out of date now because obviously it was published a long time ago, but that's my only major published work.
But I think you agree there are lessons to be learned from what happened in Eastern Europe.
Oh yes, I mean basically we're coming to the end of a whole generation of poor economic decision making based upon a poor theoretical base. In other words, the sort of neoliberal counter-revolution has finally run out of steam. But it's run out of steam intellectually. Of course, it's still rolling on, horrifyingly enough, in reality.
So sitting in Western Europe, looking across to Eastern Europe now, what have we got to learn from what you found out as part of researching that book?
Well, obviously, I mean, the situation is not entirely comparable. But, of course, you see problems in Greece are overspilling into Bulgaria now. Hungary is about to default as well on its debts, which, of course, doesn't make the news as much as Greece. Many of the problems are the same. Latvia is in a similar situation, for example, to Ireland, although they're on a much different level of basic income. So we're living in one world now, and what happens anywhere affects everything everywhere.
So what did happen in Eastern Europe? What's the basic premise of the book? It's called Market Failure.
It's called Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle, in inverted commas, because that was supposed to be ironic. We were basically critiquing the way the IMF, the World Bank and the European Union had approached the reform of East European economies. A lot of silly mistakes were made. There was a lot of arrogance and hubris. So the idea that all you've got to do is just import a few free market ideas and hey presto, you're all going to be rich. There was a very prominent philosophy at the beginning of the process. I think people are sadder and wiser now. But of course it's too late. A lot of damage has been done.
So coming back to my original question, what couple of points, you know, should we learn from the experience in Eastern Europe?
Well, what we learned in Eastern Europe is that pure free market economics is basically as abstract and as foolish a system as the communist system in many respects. One of the major mistakes they made, of course, was just presuming that the communist system could be wished away. You've had 70 years or 40 years of it. You've got to work with the grain of that. So, for example, they pushed immediate privatisation of businesses, even when the businesses were making a loss and could have been turned into profit-making businesses. What you should have done, if you did want to privatise, is you turn the business around, you turn it into something making a profit, then you talk about privatisation. But privatisation was rushed, and of course that meant that all the crown jewels, as it were, of the economy fell into the hands of sharp operators. And of course that's not dissimilar to what's happened in the West now.
Well, didn't a similar thing happen in Russia with the Russian oligarchs?
Exactly, but the Russian oligarchs are no worse and no better than the American oligarchs. We're now in one world where criminal capitalism is the dominant form, and that's the problem that we're facing.
So what is an oligarch?
Well, an oligarch is just a phrase really referring to somebody who's very, very powerful because of their money. It goes back a long way. It's a Greek term. It's a shorthand really for the Murdochs, the Berezovskis and others who basically dominate the political and social system.
Because there's this battle going on between, I think it's Abramovich and Berezovsky at the moment in London, in the courts.
Indeed.
And in a way it's slightly bizarre, isn't it, because you had a Russian communist system, which was supposed to be completely anti-capitalist, which was replaced by these kind of super-capitalists.
Yeah, but that was quite a deliberate policy. I saw World Bank reports at the time, and they were quite explicit in saying what we've got to do is, as quickly as possible, create a capitalist class from somewhere, and that capitalist class will then basically do what we want, and the rest of the society will have to follow suit. So they didn't care where these people came from, they didn't care where they got their money from, but once you've consolidated a block of, say, 5 to 15% of the population who are doing very well out of the new setup, and they could be ex-communists, and many of them were, like Gaidar, who was the great so-called reformer in Russia as a former, former father, as a former Red Army general and so on. Doesn't matter where they came from, but once you've created that class, they then become your partners for doing whatever you want to do. And that's exactly what happened. Whereas if you were going to reform in the interests of ordinary people, you would basically take your time and try and make sure that the vast majority of people benefited from the reform. But that wasn't the policy.
But these oligarchs were working completely outside the democratic system. Were they actually in any way, you think, opposed to that system?
No, they weren't working outside the democratic system. What happened was...
They're just private businessmen.
Indeed, but there wasn't much of a democratic system to start with. So just at the same time as you're introducing a democratic system, which probably requires, you know, quite a lot of care if it's going to be done properly, at the same time you're carrying through a very extreme economic reform. So, for example, in the former Soviet Union, prices went up through the roof, 1,000% inflation, at the same time as everybody lost their jobs. Now, in actual fact, that's probably where the Western world is now going. We are going to have a similar crisis because, in actual fact, all of these things are linked together. And what links them is this absurd free market philosophy, neoliberal philosophy, which when I was trained as an economist, if I can imagine myself as being a trained economist, we regarded most of this stuff as old hat and silly. But a whole generation has gone by with people younger than me being brought up to believe that this free market mathematicalized economics is in fact the correct a way to approach it's just wrong.
How have they been convinced that it works? Because we're seeing now in the news daily examples of how it isn't working. So how has a whole generation of economists been convinced?
Partly it's because of intellectual failure. The Black-Scholes theorem and the derivatives market are based on this idea that because of modern computers and clever people with mathematical brains, they can come up with very, very slinky financial products which will never fail. Now, you don't have to be a genius to realise that there might be something wrong with that, and of course there was. And the fundamental Benoit Mandelbrot, who is a French mathematician, was at the same time as they were developing the derivatives market and the whole ideas behind it, he was pointing out that fractal mathematics is how the world really works, where small changes in initial conditions can lead to big changes in final outcomes, which are not predictable, even in principle. So while these people are erecting a house of cards on their fantastic mathematical predictability of thesis, he's undermining the whole basis of that in pure maths. But of course, economics is a very, very ideological subject. And what's going on in the rest of science doesn't really affect them because they're in a bubble of their own. And, of course, it made a lot of people an awful lot of money to believe this stuff, so they carried on believing it.
Now, just to get back to this so-called economic miracle that you was from your book in Eastern Europe, if you're taking a look at Russia, for example, Boris Berezovsky, he made most of his original money. He became a sort of Murdochite media mogul, but most of his original money was made through him having the franchise to sell German Mercedes cars right across the former Soviet Union. So is that a typical model for most
That's
of the
That's pretty typical. I mean, we think of people like Murdoch as media moguls, and they are, but of course they've got masses of other interests. And what they use is their media is almost like a lost leader. They use that to get the political process where they want it to be so that their other business interests can be properly protected. And that's the Berlusconi, Berezovsky model. And we're seeing this all over the world, actually, that media magnates tend to be the rich. I mean, Berlusconi had the guy who was the richest man in the country. He owned the most media. He owned virtually all of the media. And he's the prime minister. And if that's not an over-concentration of power, I don't know what is.
So this chap you collaborated with the book Market Failure on, Laszlo Andor, can you tell us about him?
Well, I mean, he was an academic at the time we collaborated on the book, and I wanted to collaborate with somebody from Eastern Europe so that it wasn't just a Western perspective. And it took us 5 years to write because we had a lot of research and kind of discussion to finalise the text. But he is currently, he's not an academic anymore, he's now a top civil servant for Hungary. He represents Hungary on the board of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, based in London.
And what is that bank? What's its job?
Well, it was set
up. Because we get lots of these banks. There's the European Central Bank.
It was set up in the early 90s as a way for to specifically focus on the problems of the former communist countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. It's slightly widened its remit in recent times. It's been their people have been out to Egypt, I understand, which is outside of their remit. But you've got something like the Asian Development Bank, for example, would be a similar kind of thing based just around Asia. And it was originally conceived by Jacques Attali and others from the French civil service, who wanted a bank that wouldn't be under 100% control from Washington. But when they started to do things that the IMF and Washington didn't like, Attali was removed and they were whipped back into line. But Laszlo is still working for them.
And isn't there a sort of something rather nasty about this whole idea of development? I mean, he's got development in the title of that bank, where you're going in, you're lending money generally to for a infrastructure project or for a big mine or something like that. But then ultimately you're expecting interest back, and it's a kind of money-making exercise. You're not going around really gifting money, or you're not making donations. This is not a benevolent enterprise.
No, but they're also able to pick up things that the private sector won't pick up. And that's the whole point. Nevertheless, of course, they are part of the general consensus which pushes for privatisation, deregulation and so forth. I think there's always a fight inside these institutions between people who want them to be more people-focused and people who want them to be more market-focused, if you like. But public sector banks like that are potentially part of the solution, but often end up being part of the problem because they just basically do what the private sector wants.
What about the European Central Bank, though? What's the genesis?
Well, that's
of that?
A rather different. That's a rather different beast. I mean, that's there to underpin the euro, and it's got a currency to manage, as it were. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development is a much less grandiose animal than that.
Because there's a lot of tension right now in the European Central Bank as to what direction it's going to go.
There is. People are at the bank. The bank is already basically buying up bonds and trying to support the situation in Italy and Greece and so on. And some people suggesting that that's not really what they ought to be doing. It's not really strictly in their remit. And the remit was very strictly written in the first place because it was basically designed to make the German people happy that the bank was not going to be a money printing bank. It was going to be a very, very conservative institution. But that, of course, means that its hands are tied in this kind of situation.
But it does imply that there are some really quite serious political tensions at the heart of the European Central Bank right now.
There are indeed. That's exactly the case. I mean, I think the French would very much like it to take on a central bank role, a traditional central bank role like the Fed or the Bank of England, and the Germans are extremely resistant. So that's a big argument to be had.
But if you look at both the Fed and the Bank of England, they have some serious shortcomings, don't they?
They do, and I have sympathy with the German point of view, is that we're not going to print money like the British and the Americans. On the other hand, what the other side are saying is if you don't print money, the world financial system is going to crash, and they are also correct.
What about this whole thing of the debt spiral? Because we do seem to be in a situation where it's impossible to continually increase taxes to pay off the deficit when there is increasing unemployment. We had the figures here in Britain just last week of an extra 120,000 people unemployed. Now, that's flipping people from taxpayers into taking money from the national economy.
That's correct, but it's not so much that taxes, it's cuts that are causing the austerity, which are the cutting edge of austerity. They ought to raise taxes on wealth, basically, because wealthy people don't spend all their money. They can't. Most of it they will use for speculative purposes if they've got more than they need. You take that off them and pump it in at the bottom. That's what should happen. And you have to run some kind of a deficit in this situation. That's what my economics tutors used to say, although some fools believe that we've got to balance the books. In Britain, of course, politically, the government seems to be winning the argument that the books have to be balanced. I think people will only realise that that's wrong when the economy crashes. But that's a separate issue. I think that the European Central Bank, like all institutions now, are in crisis. That's basically what's happening. I read the LEAP 2020, which is an anticipation bulletin produced in Paris, and they predicted that there is going to be a massive geopolitical crisis in 2012, and that we're only at January the 23rd or whatever it is, and that certainly looks as if it's shaping up.
So isn't there something fundamentally wrong with the system that all these politicians, we keep having these meetings, we have one just before Christmas to sort out the euro crisis, apparently everything's going to be sorted out by March, but where are they going to find the money from? Isn't it actually impossible to find the money, since when this cash is being generated over the last 20, 30 years or whatever, one thing that hasn't actually been created is the interest, the money that's the interest that's got to pay these loans. It doesn't seem that it's going to come from anywhere.
Well, that's quite right, and I think that today they've been trying to get the bondholders of Greek debt to accept a voluntary haircut, as they call it, which basically means they have to lose some of their money. They're being very resistant, and of course it has to be voluntary, because if it's involuntary, because Greece could just turn around and say we're not going to pay, that's absolutely in the capitalist rule book, by the way. People have got to understand this. You don't have to pay your debts. You turn around and say we're not going to pay. That's why interest is paid in the first place. Whoever lends you the money has taken a guess on your likelihood of repayment, and the interest will reflect that. And that's why you pay interest when you borrow money. So in actual fact, you are entitled to walk away from your debts, and people do. In the 30s, every Latin American country, without exception, walked away from its debts, and that's what will happen this time.
But if you take the comparison with, say, a mortgage, if you don't pay your mortgage, the bank repossesses your house.
Not necessarily. Basically, you can renegotiate. I mean, basically, it's not in the bank's interest to chuck you out and then force all these houses onto the market, which means their other houses are worth less and so on. It's in everybody's interest to come to some arrangement. It makes more sense if you've lent me money to come to an arrangement with me which I can pay, rather than make me walk away because I can't pay it at all.
But you seem to be implying that the Greeks won't be able to pay.
Well, they can't. I mean, I think that's the fundamental circle that they can't square. Or swear that they can't circle, which is that the Greeks are not in a position to pay, and beating them harder will not make them. It's like beating a slave that's already falling down with ill treatment. They are not going to pay, but if you beat them any harder.
Now, there are a lot of people who are saying that there is actually a sort of class angle to this and a political angle.
Well, absolutely. What we're seeing really is what the Marxists, and I consider myself to be a Marxist, would call the class struggle. You've got the wealthy classes and their interests, and they represent a very small fraction of the population, and everybody else is basically being bamboozled to go along with what they need and what they want. There's no reason why we should bail all these people out. They've just got the political power to force us
but,
to do
but
so.
But all these countries are democracies. Surely people can vote in a government which will simply say, well, we're not paying this debt, and or we are going to be taxing the rich.
Yeah, but you forget that in democracies, politicians need two things. They need votes to win, and they also need money to kind of get their message across to those who might vote for them. And of course, that's the point at which the money comes into the process. And people who, we have to build a political movement which is going to demand these things, but at the moment we haven't got it, because the political forces across Europe, but of left or right, have basically accepted the neoliberal settlement. So it became very difficult then to turn around to the people and say, actually, no, we're going to have to do something different, because the political class, including in Britain and elsewhere, are basically bought into the whole process. So that there isn't actually any political forces on the field of play which are able to actually bring forward the demands which are necessary. And the population is just shell-shocked and confused and just goes along with what they're being told.
But, I mean, isn't it also the case that people are looking at this crisis looming, and they are extremely nervous that if there is some kind of large default in the Eurozone, that this will come straight back to the City of London, and we'll see a whole house of cards come down collapsing?
Well, that's exactly what will happen. But, of course, what people in Britain seem to think, in the comfortable classes, is that this is all to do with the Eurozone, and we're glad we're out of it, and it's their problem, let them deal with it. But of course they don't realise that the British banking system, which is at the centre, see, it's not just a Euro crisis, there's a crisis across the globe, and it all comes back to the City of London, even more so than Wall Street.
Well, surely less so these days.
No, more so these days. The City of London, basically, during the bubble, was doing even more dodgy things than Wall Street. So many of the Wall Street banks opened up their offices here because they couldn't get away with stuff in the US, which they could get away with in the city. And Britain's only real industry is the city, which is why we defend, the Tory government defends it tooth and nail against things like Tobin taxes and so on. But when it goes down, it will be like a black hole. Will suck the British economy in straight away, and then other stars will be sucked in with it. And it's a very, very bad situation. Most of the people in charge don't know what to do. They thought that we would never get to a situation like this, but here we are. And I'm afraid there will be a disorderly breakdown. I can't see any other possibility here. I'm not wishing it on people. I mean, many decent politicians in the EU are doing their best to prevent a disorderly breakdown, but I'm afraid it's going to happen.
But we do hear that, at least we heard over Christmas, that the Treasury is looking at these various Armageddon scenarios, so at least there's an inkling of hope that potentially, anyway, our elected representatives in the Treasury have got a plan of some sort to deal with this kind of black hole.
It's not the elected representatives, it's the civil servants. And, of course, they're not actually publicising the fact that they're running around in emergency mode, because they're trying to say to everybody on the outside, don't panic, don't panic. Inside, we know they are panicking,
it's a sort of
they should be.
Schizophrenia here, where, you're saying one thing and doing something else.
Well, it's like, what would you do if you're the captain of the ship that's sinking? Do you, you know, you have to make some decisions. Are you going to stay and die? Are you going to help the people off the boat? And at the same time, if you start panicking, they're going to start panicking. So,
or as we saw in the Costa Concordia, yeah, you just leave the thing in a really rather irresponsible fashion.
Well, that's what will happen. The people, the wealthy net worth individuals who have been the big beneficiaries of this, we talk about the banks, but it's the wealthy net worth individuals behind the banks that we're talking about now, basically the wealthy classes. And when it all goes down, they will take up their money and walk away. And that's why they're relatively blasé about the crisis, because in actual fact they've done rather well out of it. They win either way, and so they're not actually taking it that seriously. It's the ordinary people who will take the hit.
Well, you seem to be implying that a lot of people in extremely responsible positions in society today are either incompetent or simply shouldn't be in those positions. How has it come that these people who really are not live enough to think with the times, to change their thinking, to deal with the circumstances as they are, how have they got into positions of power?
Well, there are two reasons. One is kind of groupthink, if you like. So even people who mean well tend to go along with what everybody else says because they feel that they've got to. So, and I think that's what's happened in the economics profession, although there are plenty of good economists out there, in the universities mainly, who critique these things. But if you work in business or finance, you start to lose your critical edge. You are a businessman or a financier, not an economist anymore. Economists, you know, are supposedly scientists and objective, but of course once you're in the system, you're not objective. And the other factor is, of course, as has always happened throughout history, is that the powerful and wealthy and those with the guns tend to dominate everybody else, and democracy is a very, very weak in actual fact. It always has been a rather weak beast.
You seem to be implying it's almost a sort of sideshow, kind of just there for the public.
Well, I think the only time that democracy really was strong in the West was after the Second World War, and all of the sacrifices that had been made to get rid of Nazi Germany and so on, that there was a genuine commitment to making sure the ordinary people were heard. But gradually that's been eroded by the traditional forces that erode such things, that is to say, the wealthy classes who got fed up with paying for welfare as they saw it and decided they were going to get rid of it.
Now, you're an old Labour Oxford economist. What are your thoughts about the opposition in Westminster, the Labour opposition?
Well, obviously, in the last week or so, we've seen them accepting the logic of austerity, which is very disappointing from my point of view.
Well, that's not really as a party, it's more as a leadership. And I wonder, do you think that that really captures the spirit of the whole
party?
No,
I would suggest that many activists in the party are very dismayed. I am an activist in the party and I am dismayed.
And what about trade unionists?
Well, the trade union leadership are definitely dismayed. But, of course, the problem is that the propaganda that this is all absolutely inevitable and there's no choice has now been reinforced by the Labour Party leadership, by Ed Miliband and Ed Balls. And that then really rather makes it difficult for us to make the case against the government that they're doing the wrong thing. I think they've done it in order to try and appear moderate and middle of the road, but you can't really be middle of the road about with a bus coming towards you. You've got to jump, and I think we should have jumped to the left.
So how has it happened that just one or two or a handful of people at the apex of a political party can ignore the wishes, in this case potentially anyway, of tens of thousands of members?
Because the democratic structure of the party has been eroded over many years. And in a sense, being in the Labour Party today in Britain is like being in the Communist Party in Eastern Europe in the 80s. And, of course, people who wanted to change things did join the Communist Party to get some kind of influence. But, of course, you don't have as much influence as you would like.
Okay, what about the euro crisis? Because we heard before Christmas there was a big meeting, which David Cameron famously said, "Well, I'm going to veto this agreement." And so he was saying that Britain would not take part in the euro rescue plan. Now that was all set; everyone signed up in the eurozone, and the idea was that by March this year, everything would be sorted. March 2012, everything would be sorted, and there would be a final treaty and a new arrangement to solve the euro crisis and to make sure that the euro can continue as a currency. So, I mean, what do you think the prospects are for March?
Well, it's not looking good, is all I can say. And another factor which is quite important that people need to take into account is that there's going to be a presidential election in France in April, which may remove Sarkozy, bring in François Hollande, it looks like, at the moment, and he's got a much more robust line on some of these issues than Sarkozy has.
Can you give us a bit of François's political background?
Well, I mean, he's a rather colourless, technocratic sort of character. But he's not. He does. He's not. He's more predictable than Monsieur Sarkozy. Let's
put
it that way.
Did he used to work for Goldman Sachs, like
No. He's, one of the things he said in an election rally last week, François Hollande, is I am the enemy of the financial sector, and that's what he's going to go to the electorate with. Now that may change the dynamic if the French decide to march to the left. It may give others courage to do the same.
Now, there was thoughts that Dominique Strauss-Kahn may have been standing in the presidential elections.
Yes, well, he's
the head of the IMF.
He has been removed. Let's put it that way. And of course, there are suspicions in France that regardless of his personal behaviour, that his removal is basically what took place there. But I think we shouldn't get too carried away by changes of politicians from the existing elites, because to a certain extent, they've all bought into this all the way. And it would be nice to think that there were people there with the courage and the skill to take on these powerful oligarchs, but you shouldn't hold your breath. It really needs the ordinary people to get moving, and that has not yet happened. And that's partly because people are complacent, partly because they're shocked, and partly because they've not been given a clear lead to follow. But once the crash happens, and I believe it will happen this year, I'll go out on the record and say that right now, I think there will be a crash this year. Once that happens, then we'll be in a different game. But the dangerous thing is that ordinary people won't necessarily get rational at that point and start thinking about what needs to be done in a democratic way. They start to lash out and basically fight with each other. Sunnis versus Shias, Muslims versus Christians, Catholics versus Protestants, rich versus poor, if you like, in a very negative kind of way. We're going to see a big increase in crime and resentful attitudes all round, aren't we?
You seem to be implying a sort of financial 9/11, you know, because when 9/11 happened, there was a very, very tough reaction from the US, the Patriot Act, domestic repression, and also foreign wars starting.
Yes, and of course, if you think there is going to be a crash, and many of the insiders probably do, then they will simply be taking appropriate evasive action. The ordinary folk are the people who will take the hit. And of course, we've also got the problems, the geopolitical problems in the Gulf, with very dangerous brinkmanship going on. It looks like the run-up to 1914 to me. Anybody just could fire a stray shot in the Strait of Hormuz now, and we'll have the oil price whacked up through the roof, the banks will definitely collapse, and we'll be in a major, potentially nuclear war. That's where we are.
So you seem to be implying that the March Eurozone settlement, the final settlement, is really not going to happen.
I think it's not going to happen for all kinds of practical reasons. And in any case, all that's happening here is finding another way to bail the banks out again. And at a certain point, we've got to give up. We just can't do that. They've had their chance. They've been bailed out once, been bailed out more than once, and nothing has changed. So I'm afraid, ultimately, the market is the market, and it will crash because there's too much debt in it. And that's what the solution, the market solution to all this debt, is quite simple. Have a crash, wipe it out.
Is there any way, if people have got savings, to protect those savings?
Well, in a way, people are supposedly protected up to, I think it's £50,000 in this country. Most people, that will be fine with. But that doesn't help the banks, because the very wealthy people have got a lot more than £50,000 in, and when they get wiped out, that they only get £50,000 back, then that's an awful lot of wealth being wiped out. But ultimately, the wealth of the wealthy classes has to be wiped out in two ways. One, where it's not real wealth, where it's only paper wealth, it should just be written off. And two, a substantial chunk of their real wealth, Cameron's worth 30 million, Tony Blair's worth 60 million, I would take at least half of that off them to pay off the deficit. And on we go. Because don't forget that these people have done very well out of the bubble. The bubble was all wrong. They did very well out of it. Where's all the money gone? Into their pockets. We need that money out of their pockets. People say you can't take people's money off them. I say it's a national emergency. It's national survival. It's like 1940. They are going to have to dig into their pockets. And politicians are going to have to say that's what they're going to do before they're elected, so that everybody knows what the score is. That's what Roosevelt did in the 30s in the US. But we haven't got politicians of sufficient courage or vision yet.